This is part one of an interview with Mr. Bill Whittaker.
It's taking place in his home in Putney in Sydney. The date is the 16th of November 2007. The project is the City of Sydney's oral history project on horses in inner Sydney. And it's Margot Beasley interviewing. So, Bill, if you wouldn't mind, if you could just tell me where and when you were born.
Yes, Margot, I was born in far north Queensland, west of Cairns, on the Atherton Tablelands, at a little hamlet called Malanda, surrounded by dairies, mainly dairying. My people, my grandparents and my parents were dairy farmers.
So what year was that?
I was born in 1929, and we left there in the Atherton Tablelands in 1942 when my father said there were Japanese. I was 12, and the Japanese were had bombed Darwin, and we were situated in a beautiful primary producing area where there was a butter factory and a bacon factory, and loads of food for Japanese soldiers. And my father was afraid that they'd invade, and the first place they would have gone would have been the Atherton Tablelands for the food. And I had two teenage sisters and a relatively young mother in her early 40s, and my father decided we'd get out because he'd read of Japanese atrocities in China, in Shanghai and Peking. So we left in a hurry and we came to Sydney, thankfully.
And so where did you spend the next years in Sydney when you were still with your family?
Oh, we went to Maroubra, and which was close to Randwick Racecourse, and we were there for 10 years, and then we went to Rosebery, and very close to the old Rosebery Racecourse and Victoria Park and, of course, Randwick, where there were horses galore. That was in the 1950s, and there's always been horses pretty close to me.
Well, which leads me to the reason that I'm interviewing you, and we're really talking today primarily about trotting at Harold Park, but you also had a very long career in journalism, writing about horse racing of various kinds.
Yes, galloping and trotting for more than 50 years.
So maybe could you just give us a bit of an outline of your journalism career? Where did you start?
Yes, well, I started as a very young racing writer. I was 19. I'd worked in the public service before that, and I was unhappy being a junior clerk in the customs house, actually, in Sydney. And anyway, a friend of mine got a job writing about racing on the Newsletter, which was a weekly Sydney publication devoted entirely to racing and a little trotting, as from 1949 when night trotting started in Sydney. So I was a 19-year-old and night trotting had started. I'd been to Randwick, I guess, hundreds of times, and Rose Hill and the galloping tracks, but I'd never been to a trotting track until night trotting started in 1949. It was a memorable time for trotting. But anyway, I was working on the Newsletter, and being the youngest and the most inexperienced, the editor, a fellow who went under the pseudonym of the Mug Punter, he sent me to Harold Park. He said, "You go to Harold Park." So I went, and really I loved the horses, the trotting horse, but that I didn't know anything about. I knew a bit about gallopers, but not about trotting. But right from day one, I not only liked the horses, but I liked the people. They were largely tradesmen and primary producing farmers that I'd been reared with as a boy in the north. And I got on very well with them almost from day one. And I got to love, as I said, I got to love the trotting scene, which, you know, it didn't have a very high reputation in that period, or over a long period. They were called the Red Hots, and, you know, An old friend of mine, George Breen, used to call them thieves on wheels, the trotting drivers. But it wasn't true. It was that was a terrible exaggeration. In my view, they were mostly, 9 out of 10 were honest and hardworking, and very keen competitors. And I think that, and I've always thought, and I think to this day, that they're more, they're superior horsemen to the galloping trainers.
Oh, why do you say that?
Well, they're closer to their horse. I mean, nearly every trotting trainer driver that I've known over the last almost 60 years, they can doctor their own horses.
By doctor, you mean attend well, to their health?
Well, yes, they can. They know how to use needles and how to give them vitamins, and they know how to shoe them. Imagine, for example, imagine Gay Waterhouse shoeing a horse. You can't imagine it, can you? Even though she's a wonderful horse trainer, but she has a staff and directs them, whereas the trotting person is very close to his horse. It's a good example, a good contrast. Gay Waterhouse compared with, say, Paul Fitzpatrick, who's the leading trotting trainer at the moment. Paul Fitzpatrick would know precisely how to shoe a horse, how to mouth it, how to fix its teeth, and would do it himself, or know how to do it himself. Whereas many of the galloping trainers, they don't do that sort of work with horses.
Would that be because there's less money in trotting than in galloping?
Yes, precisely. Yes, yes. There's less money, and in, you know, I'd say 7 out of 10 trotting trainer drivers, it's a hobby. Maybe 6 out of 10, about 60%. It is a hobby. They have other activities, and that in itself is a difference. It makes them very independent. The licensed person in trotting is considerably more independent, and in many cases more affluent than the galloping man. They mostly own properties, usually on the outskirts of Sydney. Which you know, the property boom has meant that a lot of them have got fortunes in or sitting on fortunes in property. They've shifted out further. They used to be, 50 years ago, they were around places like Bankstown and Granville and Liverpool. Now they've shifted further out, and they've got a lot of money for their properties. Blacktown is another. Kevin Newman, who was the leading trainer here for many years, he had a property, 50 acres at Blacktown. Well, he sold it a few years ago. You can imagine how much it was worth. And Penrith also. Penrith is another great trotting centre where there's lots of trotting trainers on 5-acre properties and 10-acre properties. They have their own training track. They have tractors to you know, to improve the surface of their tracks. They have a lot of equipment, considerably more equipment than the galloping trainer, because they need it. The gear for a trotting horse is about 3 times more than the gear for a galloper, who requires a saddle and a bridle, maybe a surcingle and a breastplate. But trotting horse, the gear for a trotting horse is considerable. You know, the harness that they have to put on them to keep them, the pacer, to keep him at his proper gait.
Now, you said when night trotting started in Sydney, that was a really big event.
Yes.
I wonder if you could just tell me a little bit about Harold Park before the night trotting. It had been there for quite a long time, hadn't it?
Race. Harold Park's got a very stormy and interesting history. It was originally called Lily Bridge. As you know, Margot, it's situated in the Glebe Hollow, reclaimed land. It was a swamp. In about 1880, it was still a swamp adjacent to, you know, the Glebe. There were Glebe abattoirs and things like that down there, but the Harold Park or the... the area where Harold Park now is was a swamp, and even to this day, when it rains heavily, there's a lot of water in the middle. But anyway, it was called Lily Bridge, and in the 1890s, there was pony racing. They had a track, a very small track. It was about 2.5 furlongs around. That's about less than 600 metres, and they had pony racing and trotting, a proprietary body that was a bit shadowy, a bit shady, but they had bookmakers there, no tote, but they had bookmakers, and in actual fact they had night racing. They lit it up in, I think the year was 1895 or 1896, and it was popular for a while, but the skullduggery was considerable, and it didn't last. So it was then sold, the property was sold and developed by the New South Wales Rugby Union Football. And they owned it. Then the trotting, a group of men formed what they called the New South Wales Trotting Club. And they were interested in having trotting meetings. They'd previously raced in Sydney along, they called it Moore Park Road, it's now Anzac Parade, and they used to have Saturday afternoon meetings there, just stake money with the owners, many of them very wealthy, including one of the Hordens, the original Anthony Horden actually raced along Moore Park, along the Moore Park Road. But there was no betting, or very little, only side wagering. But anyway, they formed the New South Wales Trotting Club, and the Trotting Club at first leased it was called Lily Bridge, and when the Rugby Union took it over, it was called Forest Lodge. And the Trotting Club leased it from the Union, and for 6 or 7 years, they raced there at the Forest Lodge track. It was an 800-metre, half-mile track, and they had meetings there, and they also, there was a problem with the lease, and they went to Kensington Racecourse, where the New South Wales University is now. There was a racecourse there, and the Trotting New South Wales Trotting Club held 8 or 9 meetings at Kensington, a place of great learning now, of course. And then they came back to Harold Park in about 1904 or 1905. It was then called, it was Lily Bridge first, then Forest Lodge, and then they renamed it Epping. And they raced there regularly. They had, I think they had 12 meetings a year at first and then 20. Until 1929, when due to the confusion with the suburb of Epping, out in the Eastwood Epping area, they renamed it Harold Park. It was renamed Harold Park because Andrew Town, who was one of the great trotting horse breeders and thoroughbred breeder of Hobartville Stud near Richmond, Andrew Town had imported a great stallion, American bred, but he imported it from Scotland. It was named Child Harold, H-A-R-O-L-D, the boy's man's name. And so the name was changed from Epping to Harold Park in as late as 1929. And of course it's been Harold Park ever since.
Now, when the night trotting came in, you've talked about that as a very significant event.
Yes.
What can you tell me a bit about that? Why was it significant?
Oh, yes. Well, daytime trotting, it prospered at times, and, you know, the Depression came in 1929, and the first years after they'd renamed it, and things were tough. There was very little money. And daytime trotting had big disadvantages. They couldn't race Saturday because it would have been in opposition to the galloping, which had been going for 100 years. They were a relatively new sport, and they couldn't really compete for the punting for the punters, for patronage from the punters when the races would have been that Saturday. It was every Saturday afternoon racing in Sydney. So they had to race Monday afternoons. There were two tracks, Harold Park and Victoria Park. Victoria Park was established in 1911 by Sir James Joynton Smith. And Sir James Joynton Smith played a very active and prominent role in the establishment of daytime trotting at Victoria Park, which he owned. Sir Joynton Smith is one of the most interesting characters in Sydney history. He was Lord Mayor of Sydney for several years. He was second president of the New South Wales Rugby League, the organisation which has flourished so much. He actually supported the Rugby League when they broke away from the Rugby Union. Sir Joynton Smith established Smith's Weekly, the newspaper, very prominent newspaper, and he also built the Carrington Hotel at Katoomba. He also built a beautiful arcade. I think it was called the Victoria Arcade down near the Australia Hotel and the Prince Edward Theatre in the old days in Sydney. It was a beautiful arcade that sadly has been demolished. But so you can see he was very prominent, and he lifted the image of trotting in Sydney. He was also chairman of the South Sydney Hospital, and when Victoria Park was established, from the proceeds of the first meeting, he in fact donated £500, a lot of money then, to the South Sydney Hospital charity to help improve it and establish the place.
So trotting, I mean, Victoria Park is also known for pony racing, isn't it?
Oh, it was a galloping pony gallop, yes,
but
it was.
But they did, there was quite a bit of harness.
Oh, yeah, they raced at Victoria Park, they had 20 meetings a year, and Harold Park, the New South Wales Trotting Club at Harold Park, had 20 meetings a year, that was 40 meetings, and they'd race Monday afternoons. And they'd race one Monday afternoon, and Harold Park would be the next Monday afternoon, alternatively. So trotting swung along pretty. There were ups and downs, but it went along well. But compared with galloping, it was a small fry.
And it could only ever be, presumably, if they were racing on Monday afternoons, because you can't get the crowd.
No, if people work, that's the thing we're getting to about night trotting. So they struggled along, at times very successfully. In the case of Harold Park and Victoria Park, they were both really financed. In the case of Victoria Park, they were financed by the gallops. They used to have gallop pony meetings on a Wednesday. I think they had 20 gallop meetings a year, so that kept their finances going. And in the case of Harold Park, greyhound racing. The New South Wales Trotting Club ran greyhound racing at Harold Park and ran it very well and very profitably, more profitably than trotting. They ran the greyhound racing at Harold Park from the 1920s, the late 1920s, until 1950. The New South Wales Trotting Club. Some people used to say, the old fellas that I knew in the early days of night trotting in the 50s used to say that they ran dog racing with less bias and more honestly than trotting. Dog racing helped finance it and helped prop up the prize money for the trotting for many years. But the main thing about daytime trotting was that people went to work. So, after political wrangling for 20 years, it took 20 years for them to break down the barriers associated with the establishment of night trotting. You've got to realise that the motion picture industry had a strong political had political strength, and they fought against night trotting because it was obviously going to be an opposition to the moving pictures. The churches were against it. The Salvation Army, they agitated strongly against it for years and years in Parliament House.
Would that have been on an anti-gambling
yes,
platform?
Yeah, of course. That terrible word, I don't like it at all, but it was used extensively in the betting circles at the time. They were called wowsers. And night trotting was held back. It was almost established in 1940. Bill McKell, Premier of New South Wales, was really a patron saint of trotting. No person was more pro-trotting in Sydney than later Sir William McKell. He owned many trotters and he also owned many gallopers. He established the Sydney Turf Club, of course. He was a real horse man, McKell. He owned a property at Goulburn, he bred horses, he came from the country, and a very interesting character in the history of both galloping and trotting. He raced a very good pacer. It was trained by Jack Watts. The name does escape me, but it was a very good horse. But he raced many horses, trained mostly at Victoria Park in later years by Ernie Burns, whose son Bernie Burns was a very successful galloping trainer in later years. But anyway, getting back to night trotting, the establishment of it, the war came, so it was Bill McKell almost had it in the state parliament. The legislation was almost passed. It was only defeated by one or two votes in 1939. And the war came, so that put a stop to it until 1945. The war ended then. So from 1945 to 49, the politicians argued about whether it should be established, and finally in 1948, December 1948, the legislation was passed for the establishment, and they work under an act. It's called the Night Trotting Act. And so Harold Park was closed in November or December 1948, so that in order to improve the place, to provide for the bigger crowds. It was very much run down. They had raced there on Saturday afternoons during the war. Both dog racing and trotting was held continually at Harold Park in the war years, but very... Well, not the dogs. The dogs always had big crowds during the war years, but it was always day racing, not Saturday afternoon. So Harold Park closed down from December until October 1949. 10 months. There was no racing at all, no trotting in Sydney. And the big night was scheduled for late September. And you wouldn't want to know, of course, the rain came, and that had to be postponed until October 1, 1 week. It was the day of the Epsom Handicap was run that afternoon at Randwick, and it rained. A grey horse called Denali, ridden by the great Scobie Breasley, won the Epsom, and I can distinctly remember we all left Randwick to go to Harold Park, and... the crowd was 15,000, which was disappointing, actually. They thought they might get 25,000, but it rained and it was a terrible, windy, miserable day. But 15,000 was still about seven times more than they'd had at the daytime trots. The betting went up by about 400%. The totalisator, it really was a huge success, even though they were disappointed with the crowd.
So what was it like there on the night?
It was very crowded, and there were three enclosures. There was the paddock, the ledger and the flat. The lights, at that time, we thought the lights were brilliant. It was overhead lighting. It was all second hand. When it got publicity that they were establishing night racing at Harold Park, there was a dreadful outcry, because in 1949 there was still a material shortage of building materials, and they couldn't
after
get
the war.
Yes, and the Labor government were building housing commission homes, and they couldn't get materials for them, and there was a dreadful outcry, but the New South Wales Trotting Club committee assured the government, and it was an official assurance that they would use only second-hand material. That's how they got over it. That for the track.
So where did they get the lights from?
I'm not sure, but it was an electrical company that worked at Harold Park for years. They established it. It was a Sydney Electrical company. My memory has let me down there.
No, it doesn't.
But
I thought you might know.
They became very old-fashioned. They were over the track, like a web of lights all around for the half mile. They're long gone, you know, they were so out of date. I remember one night an old trotting driver, he was a big fella, Snowy Finn. It was an accident and he was catapulted high in the air and he hit the lights.
Oh dear.
Yes, and because of the heat of the lights, they often blew out and there was glass from the bulbs on the track. And then, of course, came the Bunurong power shortages and the coal strikes. And I remember one night at Harold Park, I think it was 1950, when the lights all went out before the first race. And we all sat in the dark for 2 hours until the Bunurong powerhouse worked up enough power. And that caused another outcry. You know, people were demanding to know why they were wasting power on lighting up a gambling place like Harold Park. So Harold Park invested in electricity, what do you call them?
Generator.
A generator of their own. It cost them plenty, and it worked very well. But in Sydney in that period, there was a fellow called Mr. Conde, C-O-N-D-E, who was famous at that time because he was in charge of the Bunurong powerhouse and the lighting of Sydney. And he got a lot of unfavourable publicity. They were strange times. And then, of course, the miners went on strike and there was coal shortages. So the generator at Harold Park was very important. But I couldn't stress the importance of dog racing to the success in the early days of night trotting at Harold Park.
It's financial success is important.
But, financially, yes. Because the dog racing at Harold Park started in 1946, March, or February, March 1946, the light night racing started at the dogs. The track was already there, and the lights, they had night dog racing before the war, so the lights were already there for the dog track.
So what sort of people were there on that first night?
Well, completely different to the crowd now. People, it was a night out and people really dressed up. The men wore suits and the ladies were beautifully groomed, as it was for the first 10 years of night trotting. It was a night out. And then the whole way of living changed in Sydney. The golden years were from that night in 1949 until the early 60s. You know, the whole way of living changed with 1956 television. It started. We didn't realise that what a difference, how it would take away the people from all outdoor sports, and more important, the legislation for the legalisation of poker machines in clubs in, I think it was 1956 or 55, at about the same time as television. And it was a double whammy for the trots, I can assure you, that trotting and dog racing too. Night sports suffered badly with the introduction of poker machines in clubs and, you know, the magnificent facilities that they provided in clubs that kept people indoors. And
what, in comfort and...
Yeah, they took
the gambling dollar.
Yes, they did.
Or pound, as it
was. Yes. It had an enormous... effect on how people spent their money in Sydney. And of course, along came in 1975, along came colour television, and then a few years later the satellite, where you can sit at home on a Friday night and watched a test cricket match from England or a rugby league game or Wimbledon. Every week there's some big event, and now, in recent years, Friday night rugby league. And it's all gone, and Saturday night, it's all gone against night dog racing, night trotting. And that's why the crowds are so depleted. Because there's the opposition that they have in 2007 is just completely different to the opposition in 1949. People, the younger generation couldn't possibly understand the difference. I remember that night in 1949 how the people were so enthusiastic. It was a night out, even though the facilities were terrible.
Were the facilities there?
I mean, people in almost intolerable. They had a what they call a member's stand, that no facilities at all except viewing, and you had to pay an extra 10 shillings to get in the member's stand. The trotting club made a diabolical error for years and years in restricting the membership to 75. The membership of the New South Wales Trotting Club, it was probably the most exclusive club in Sydney, because they kept it to 75. You know, it was an old boys club. No women, of course. And it was all men, and they were to get back to the original subject, they were tradesmen and successful tradesmen. They were butchers and bakers and farmers and plumbers, and that had started originally with the use of horses around Sydney, delivering bread and meat and things like that, and brewery horses, and they were the type of people. They were good, honest men, but boy, they kept that club exclusive, 75 members, until the colonial secretary, he was called Gus Kelly, insisted. I can remember it was a Labor government in the 1960s, I guess. He insisted that they make it 100, and that they objected strongly. But the Labor government forced them to make it 100,
which was still a pretty small number.
They could have had 10,000 members, and it was to their own
detriment,
of course. And history was to show that it was probably the worst mistake they ever made.
So when you say all these tradesmen had associations with horses, working horses around Sydney, were those horses also used sometimes as trotters?
Often. You mean in work?
Yes.
The horses that would deliver the bread during the week would be walked to Harold Park or Victoria Park and raced on Saturday afternoon. Plenty of them. And I mentioned him earlier, Anthony Horden. He imported magnificent harness horses from America and England, mainly not to race. I'm talking about the pre-motor car days. I'm talking about 1890, when there was no motor cars at all. But he needed fast horses to transport him around. And Cobb and Co. also imported fast horses from America.
Well, and Horden might also have used them for deliveries, presumably.
Yes, he
not
would
just
have.
They
would
have.
But, yes, yes. He certainly would have been it was the biggest retail store in Australia, Anthony Horden's, for the first 50 years of the 20th century, also.
But you said also that a lot of the trainers, we're talking here about horses that might have been used more or less locally in Sydney as working horses during the week and then raced on Saturdays as in harness racing. But you also mentioned earlier about the trainers who have property on the outskirts of Sydney, bought a long time ago, which is now very valuable. So would there have been horses also have been coming from the outskirts of Sydney at the same time as they were coming?
They've always done that. Always. The biggest owner of harness horses in Australia in 1911, we'll say, when Harold Park was first was bought by the Trotting Club. The Trotting Club bought it from the Rugby Union. They leased it at first, and then they bought it in 1911. I think the price was £10,000. something like that. It might have been £11,000. The biggest owner at that time was a J.A. Buckland, B-U-C-K-L-A-N-D. He owned and lived on a magnificent property at Warren, and later another one at Dunedoo. Now, Buckland left medical school because he wanted to live in the country and wanted to be a farmer. He didn't want to be a professional man in the city. His father was chairman of the Bank of New South Wales, and they had plenty of money. So he owned this beautiful property at Warren, and harness racing was his hobby. And for most of his life, all he did was farm, and he trained and drove his own trotters. He had a great horse with the German name Fritz, F-R-I-T-Z, who he took to New Zealand, and he established records here at Epping, as it was called then, Harold Park. So they were the sort of people, even from day one. And then in later years, you know, some of the great horses like Paleface Adios, one of the mightiest horses and most popular horses that you could ever see, he came from a farm at Tamora. And at about the same time, another great horse, Welcome Advice, he came from Junee. Hondo Grattan, he came from Bathurst with his great trainer driver, Tony Turnbull, one of the finest characters that you could meet on a racecourse, galloping or trotting. Oh, and the Vic Frost, he came up from, he was around Dapto and then later out at Exeter. But it is an agrarian, it's a sort of a primary sport, trotting, more so than galloping.
That's an interesting thing to say, a primary sport.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
It's to do with the grassroots. It's out in the country. I mean, all the horses come from the country. Even the horses that Tommy Smith and Gay Waterhouse and Bart Cummings trained, they all came from the country, didn't they? But more so, they lived in the city as older horses. But a lot of the best horses that trotting's ever had were not only bred, foaled in the country, but they were trained in the country, and that's a big difference to thoroughbred racing.
Can you tell me what the actual attraction of trotting is for somebody like yourself or for other enthusiasts? What's its appeal?
Oh, that's easy. It's the horses. They're magnificent horses. They're not as good looking. They're not handsome, although they have improved. There's no doubt they've improved in their general looks. And their grooming too. Even when night trotting started in 1949, there were a lot of ill-gaited horses. When I first went there, they used to what they call knock their knees, and they were big, raw-boned horses that hadn't been groomed. You know, they were workhorses, but now they are racehorses. Now they're more like. They've got more like the gallop. The American influence, little short coupled, most of the American horses now, and that's where trotting started in America. It's an American sport, really. American breed, largely. They're nippy and good gaited. And their improvement is spectacular. And remarkable compared with galloping. The galloping horse has hardly improved at all. I can remember 60 years ago the record at Randwick for mile was 135, and now it's 133. They've improved 2 seconds to the mile, whereas trotting they've improved about 20 seconds to the mile. It's been extraordinary.
And is that's attributable to the
improved breeding?
Themselves?
Yes, improved breeding. The old time breeders often mated a trotting stallion with a mare that had a lot of thoroughbred blood. They thought it was good with a mare that, not a thoroughbred, but maybe the granddaughter of a thoroughbred stallion. They thought that put speed into them, but it interfered with their gait. You know, when the barrier went up, they'd want to gallop because they had that galloping instinct in them. Well, the Americans have bred all that out of them. They wouldn't have anything to do with thoroughbred blood in their horses for for 150 years, and it is good for trotting. There's no doubt that the trotting horse, maybe he's not as tough as he used to be, but he's certainly a lot faster and more reliable. They have improved considerably more than the thoroughbred. There's no doubt about that.
And the trainers of trotters were also often the drivers.
Yeah, trainer drivers, yes.
So that would help when you were talking about the very close relationship that a trainer had with a trotting horse relative to thoroughbred gallopers.
Yes.
That presumably would also help when you're actually racing.
Yeah, no doubt about it. They were closer to their horse. They trained it and they drove it and fed it and did everything. And, of course, weight had a lot to do with it. The galloping trainer couldn't ride the horse because mostly he was a man 12 stone or more, and, you know, you couldn't put a 12 stone man on a galloper, it'd faint. Whereas the trotting horse was strong enough because of his breeding, and that's another long story, the breeding of them, you know, with the... They are... The trotting horse originally, the foundation stallion of nearly all trotting horses is a horse called Messenger. And Messenger was a thoroughbred. It went from England to America in 1788 when they were starting to build roads in America. And he was a failure as a thoroughbred stallion, but when they mated him with tough Native American mares, the Red Indians were riding horses around America, in the hundreds of years ago. And when they mated the Messenger and his sons and a grandson called Hamiltonian Ten with these Native American mares, they turned out to be wonderful cart horses, and that coincided with the development of roads. They were starting to build roads in America, and they turned out to be tough horses, and they mostly had ugly heads. And,
but they weren't draft horses.
Oh, no, never draft horses.
Even though they
No, cuts. Well, Messenger was a thoroughbred, a magnificent thoroughbred. Yeah. He was a grey.
Just making the distinction here, because they were actually quite often working horses. Workhorses are often also draft horses, but that's a different
breed altogether. Yeah, a lot of the trotting horse breeders of the 19th century and into the early 20th century, they bred draft horses as well, Clydesdales.
Mm.
They were breeders. Andrew Town, who had that beautiful stud at Hobartville at Richmond, which is still in existence as a thoroughbred stud now, he was a great breeder of draft horses, Clydesdales, and so was the new Reynolds, who later took over that property, the Reynolds family, who also bred thoroughbreds there.
Mm. Now, you mentioned a bit earlier Bill McKell, being a great friend of trotting, formerly Premier of New South Wales and also Governor-General, I think.
Yes, Sir William, yes.
Sir William. And there have been other notable Sydney characters associated with trotting.
Yes, well, McKell's not the only Premier that was had a close connection with trotting. J.B. Renshaw, Jack Renshaw, who came from out in the deep western districts, he raced several good horses at Harold Park. Paddy's Knight, I think, was one, trained by Al Phyllis, was his trainer. He raced them in partnership mostly with Alan Davidson, the great test cricketer, bowler and all-rounder. And then Joe Carl, also, they were Labor, always Labor premiers. The Conservative governments were kind of anti-trotting for some reason or other. I'm not sure the reason. But it was the change of governments when the Labor lost government in the 1930s and it kept switching from one to the other, and that always delayed the introduction of trotting, because the Conservative governments who'd be in power one year and out the next, and then Labor would be in and then out the next, it held up the introduction of night trotting. But anyway, Joe Carl, Premier of New South Wales, he always went to the trotting balls, the annual trotting ball at the Trocadero in Sydney. I can remember as a young man there seeing the Premier, and he always presented the trophies and things like that. But he used to go to Harold Park occasionally to present the winners, the cup trophies. But I don't think he ever raced horses. Joe Carl, another politician of note that went to Harold Park one night was Gough Whitlam. He was there the night that Hondo Grattan won the Inter-Dominion in 1973. He presented the Inter-Dominion trophy to Tony Turnbull.
I can't imagine Gough Whitlam being much of a trotting man in general.
No, he certainly wasn't, but he'd just been... He'd become Prime Minister only 2 or 3 months previously, and it was a kind of a popular night anyway. It was an exciting night because the favourite won, and Gough was in his element there that night.
I can imagine.
Mm.
And what about businessmen associated?
Oh, well, yes. Well, it's always attracted businessmen, usually smaller businessmen. The most notable in more recent years, of course, has been Bob Ingham. Bob Ingham and his brother Jack. Jack didn't go to the trots, only maybe once or twice, but Bob would be there every night, not only at Harold Park, but every other meeting. He was a big punter, and he got so interested in the 1960s and 70s that at one stage he owned more than 100 horses. He had 100 horses
trotters in work.
Bob Ingham, yeah. Apart from being in partnership with his brother Jack with just as many gallopers at that time. But Bob Ingham is probably the most prolific trotting horse owner of the night trotting era. Bob Ingham, who is a wonderful character and... just the sort of person you'd need in trotting, but trotting has always been strange, pardon the word, but he stood for the Trotting Club Committee in the 1970s, and his vote was very disappointing. So the crowds were declining and the betting was declining even then. And he got right out of trotting. He sold. He, after that election, when he only got a handful of votes, he devoted himself then to galloping with his brother.
What do you think was the reason for him getting so little support?
Because of the attitude of that very restricted membership. They didn't really like Bob, but even though he put all that money, millions, into trotting, that staid old conservative New South Wales Trotting Club Committee didn't like big punters, and Bob was a huge punter. They didn't like that at all.
Why didn't they like it?
Oh, well, they thought that there might have been hanky panky,
sort of
yeah. And he wasn't. He was just a punter that owned horses. They were wrong, but they chased him. They virtually chased him out of trotting.
We should say here that Bob Ingham and his brother were their business was Ingham
Chickens. Yes. It's one of the best, most profitable businesses in Australia. Another very prominent businessman who stayed with trotting all his life was Jack Honan. Jack Honan's son, Jack established the Manildra flour mills and became extremely wealthy in wheat and things like that, horse food and chicken food. He was closely connected to the Inghams for quite a long period. He stayed with trotting. He used to go to America and buy very expensive young horses, and he had a property at Canoundra in the Cowra district. And another wealthy owner in more recent times was the restaurateur Carlo La Rosa, who also got out of trotting. He became disillusioned. There's really hundreds of disillusioned trotting owners that I see at the gallops all the time. Really,
why
hundreds.
Are they disillusioned?
The crowds fell off and there was no money there, and it wasn't really the fault of the administrators that the crowds fell off. It, as we outlined earlier, it was to do with all the opposition from poker machines and television, colour TV, and
so they just lose interest.
Yes, they did. And Harold Park, the facilities at Harold Park were never top class. They were always, even though they've spent a lot of money on the place in the last 15 years or last 10 years, it's still not a desirable place down in that little glebe hollow. Parking's not the best, and it's a pretty ordinary place to go. It's a concrete jungle. It's not nice. It's a great shame that they didn't shift their business to Homebush Bay. They had the chance when Nick Greiner was Premier of New South Wales and they were building the Homebush Olympic Centre. Nick Greiner went to them and made an offer to build a trotting track at Homebush in conjunction with the Olympic stadium. But I'm not sure exactly what happened because I was busy racing and not trotting at that time. But anyway, it came to nothing. But I'm sure that the Greiner government did want them to go. It would have added to the Homebush. I'm sure it would have been a success if they'd have built a modern facility for the public and, of course, increased their membership. Even now, I'm a member. I've been a member since 1980. When I stopped riding trotting in 1980, I became a member straight away. And I'm one of about there's 500 members. But it's unrestricted now. But the only thing is now they can't get members. Whereas in 1952, for example, when they ran the first Inter-Dominion at Harold Park, when you couldn't get into the place, the opening night they had 35,000 people there on the opening night of the 1952 Inter-Dominion, the first Inter-Dominion run in Sydney. I mean, they could have had 10,000 members then, I'm sure, and they restricted it to 75. And before that, it was 50.
We might start talking about the Inter-Dominion in just a moment, but I think you also mentioned that Kerry Packer used to...
Kerry Packer was the biggest punter. He and Bob Ingham were the two biggest punters at Harold Park. Kerry Packer used to go... he'd be at Harold Park nearly every Friday night. He backed almost exclusively horses trained and driven by Kevin Newman from Blacktown and Vic Frost from, as he was then, Dapto, in the Dapto area on the south coast. He punted there for about 10 years, and then when after his father died and he became boss of Channel 9, I think his business interest took him away from the place. He made a comeback at the 1980 Inter-Dominion, I remember it well, because he sat quite near us in the press box for that race. He had $100,000 to ten the winner, Koala King. So, and then he wasn't seen again. He had it from Bill Waterhouse, Bill and Robbie Waterhouse were the leading bookmakers then, the Waterhouse family, famous bookmakers. He had that bet with them. But when he was a regular punter at Harold Park, Kerry Packer always bet with Waterhouse. It was almost a straight-out contest between Kerry Packer and the Waterhouses for years.
So would the Waterhouses actually be present on the track?
Oh, yeah, they'd be.
They're very strongly associated with Randwick, so you don't really think of them in association.
They were also at the Dogs.
Mm.
Waterhouses were professional bookmakers. That was their business.
So they did everything.
Yes. They were certainly good bookmakers. Bill Waterhouse, he knew about figures, and of course he always was very well informed too. But Kerry Packer won in the end. I'd say that Packer probably won $1 million betting at Harold Park. He was very well informed. Kevin Newman, great trainer driver, and Vic Frost, they were two of the greatest who trained their horses. Nowhere near Harold Park, of course. That's the thing about it. Very few of the leading trainers in the last 40 years have been at Harold Park. Only a sprinkling. It's gradually dwindled trainers at Harold Park. Until now, there's just two or three very small-time trainers. Virtually no horses are worked at Harold Park other than horses that are brought there to just to trial to have a look at the track, and some horses.
Well, sorry, I was just going to say, so the training happens elsewhere.
Oh, yes.
Even though a lot of the training used to actually happen on the track.
In 1949, when trotting started, there would have been 500 horses trained at Harrell Park.
Where now, were they stabled, those horses?
All through the Glebe District, through streets like Wigram Road, Hereford was the Hereford Street, that's where the great Sutton McMillan had his stables, and Arundel Street was where Seymour's stables, they were called in my time, but in the 1920s and 30s, a great trainer who was killed called Jack Eddy, E-double-D-I-E, had those stables in Arundel Street, which is now a motel, I think, is it not? It's at the just near the university, where the university students stay. Well, Jack Eddy, one morning in 1938, he was the leading, or one of the leading drivers at Harrell Park for years, was driving his horse home. He was sitting in the sulky behind a mare and leading two others, and the mare reared, tossed him out of the sulky and smashed his head, and he was killed I think it was in Ross Street as he went up the hill to Arundel Street. It was a great tragedy. It's a wonder it didn't happen more often, because there were hundreds of horses walking around those streets of Glebe. You couldn't imagine. You'd have to have a vivid imagination to think that so many horses could have been in such a small area on the side of that hill going down into the Glebe Hollow. Even in my time, I remember Jack Lewis, who had a great horse called Jack Hope at the time. He had his horses stabled on the corner of Ross Street and Parramatta Road. There was a livery stable there. Even that was into the 1950s. So I think it's a service station now. It's opposite the University of Sydney.
I think, yes, it would have been the 60s when they cleared out from Glebe.
Yeah, but there were horses. As I said, there were probably 500 horses trained in that area, and I've made out a list of them there for you. There's too many of them to enumerate now, but really there were hundreds of trainers.
Some of them particularly stand out.
Well, it was Jack Eddy, Sutton McMillan, who came from I think he came from Young to Harrell Park in the 1930s, probably 1932. Jack O'Shea, who trained arguably the greatest horse ever trained there, Lawn Derby. Jack O'Shea trained that at Leichhardt, and he used to walk his horses, it'd be maybe a mile and a half, 2 miles from Leichhardt to Harrell Park every day to work them. He trained Springfield Globe and Lawn Derby, two of the all-time greats at Harrell Park. Frank Culbert. Frank Culbert's stables were at the back of Harrell Park, overlooking Jubilee Park. Wally Townsend and his brother George. Harry Cohen. Harry Cohen used to walk his horses from Newtown, and so did Jack Binskin. They'd walk them down the hill all the way through the... traffic wouldn't be anything like it is today, but...
Nevertheless, with cars on the road.
Yes, it was always a risk. And the greatest scourge of all were the tram lines. They had to dodge, and the wheels of the sulky would get caught in the groove behind the tram line. There were the Chants, Herb Chant and his son Les. Sammy Agate. Sammy Agate had been a speedway driver of cars. He had a beautiful stable up the top at Harrell Park where Caduceus, the 1960 Inter-Dominion winner, was stabled with Sam Agate at Harrell Park when he came from New Zealand. Bill and Andy Picken, they came from Newtown. A lot of these later shifted away from Harrell Park, but in the golden years, they were there. Lyle Wallace, wonderful owner-trainer. And then when in the 1950s, when the tracks in the suburbs, such as Victoria Park, Rosebery, were closed, and then Canterbury, a lot of horses... the trainers such as Jack Watson, Chris Rocher and Bubs Mazuria and Sid Buller, they came from round Mascot into Harold Park. They used to float their horses in from the Mascot area to Harold Park. So it was a hive of activity for a long period.
Now the Inter-Dominion, when did that start?
The Inter-Dominion started in Sydney in 1952, but before it really started, and the first Inter-Dominion was held in Perth where there was night trotting. Perth and Adelaide and Melbourne had night trotting long before Sydney. Perth led the way, and then Wavell in Adelaide and in the Melbourne Showgrounds in 1947. And it was an outstanding success at all three places. That was their chief argument for the establishment of it at Harold Park. It had succeeded and caused no problems whatever in those three cities.
Now, the Inter-Dominion was basically between Australian and
New Zealand
horses.
Yes, and the first, it was introduced at Harold Park in 1952. It was our turn then. It goes from state to state or city to city, and Harold Park, and it really was an outstanding success. The trotting club at the time, the president was Bill Dunlop, who was the director of AMPOL, affluent and educated and had a lot of influence in political circles in Sydney. Dunlop engaged a young PR man called Asher Joel, who later organised the PR for the Queen's tour, I think in 1954, and one of the Pope tours. Well, he was just a young PR then, and Asher Joel did an outstanding job. One of the things he did was transform the centre at Harold Park, that's now the car park, into a garden party, and they had I think 1,500 guests. They had a dance floor, they had a 15-piece band, they had tens of thousands of oysters and prawns, and they erected trees and gardens, almost instant
glamour.
Yes, and everyone that was anyone came to that. He tried to make and did a pretty good job in 1952 of making it a bit of a social event. He was long before his time, Asher Joel. And Asher became so interested in trotting that he in fact raced the horses. He became a racehorse owner in later years and a small-time punter. At Harold Park, he'd be there even after he lost the contract with the trotting club. I don't think they could afford him in later years. He'd be there regularly on a Friday night, sitting up in the press stand with us.